We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The guest in this first hour of the show is writer Sue Silverman. She says everyone has a story, and they are all worth telling. She herself is the author of two memoirs about her experiences with sexual abuse and sex addiction. And she says that while writing about pain is painful, she says it's also a profound relief. In writing about her life, she says that she is constantly reborn. With each page comes a new understanding. This morning in this hour, we'll talk with Sue Silverman about the art of the memoir. She says only by telling secrets can one become an authentic person and an authentic writer. She's here visiting the campus to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival for 2011. This is something sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. A lot of interesting things going on in connection with this. A lot of writers here on the campus to talk about their work. And if you'd like to find out more about the festival, what's going on, probably the easiest thing to do would be to go to the website of the Creative Writing Program, which you can get at through the University of Illinois. Or it's also possible to just type in the phrase Early Spring Literary Festival in your browser, and you will find it. Our guest, Sue William Silverman, is the author of two memoirs, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, and Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. She's published a collection of poetry, Hieroglyphics in Neon, and also has a book, Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir, which is about writing memoir. She does a lot of speaking and writing. She also teaches in the Low Residency MFA in Writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts. One other thing I do want to mention, that she will be doing a reading. And this will take place tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. So that's and that is open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you would like to hear from her, you feel welcome to stop by. And you can also check out some of the other things that are going on as part of the festival by going to the website. And if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Hear us. And so anybody that would be a long-distance call, that's 800-222-9455. And also there's the email if you'd like to send in a question or a comment. That way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I was looking at Fearless Confessions. And in the book, there's a section in the book where you write about the different forms that this kind of writing can take for people who are interested in, for themselves and for others, exploring their own lives and their own stories. And two major things, and I'm interested in having you talk about the difference. I think people sort of know what autobiography is, and that's one of the forms you talk about. But then you also say, well, there is something called memoir. What exactly is the difference between autobiography and memoir?
That's a really good question, because I think a lot of people are confused by that. An autobiography is usually written by somebody who's famous. You know, like Bill Clinton wrote his autobiography, My Life, and it really does look at a kind of chronological scope of somebody's entire life. You know, like first this happened to me, and it just goes sort of from beginning to end. And there's not a lot of reflection in it. It's more just what happened. And, of course, it's trying to cast you in a good light. I mean, you know, the presidents who write them or actors or actresses, you know, they want to cast themselves in a good light. So there's not a lot of exploration in it. A memoir, on the other hand, is written sort of by ordinary people like me. Like, I don't get to write an autobiography because I'm not, you know, like a famous politician or a movie star or somebody. So I'm a writer. And a memoir really is more about of a slice of a life. It's exploring one section of your life. And, you know, like that's why in my first memoir, I focused on trying to understand what what growing up in an incestuous family meant. You know, it's a lot of reflection. It's discovering the metaphor of the experience. And you know, and then with Lovesick, trying to understand the same thing kind of about recovering from sex addiction. So there's a lot of reflection, and it's not really to cast yourself in a good light. It's really more to understand what these events mean. It's an exploration. Like, how did this happen to me? And what does it mean? So that's sort of the major distinction between autobiography and a memoir.
Yeah. It's certainly true that some memoirs end up being published and people read them. I also wonder if part of the intention behind autobiography, I think, is to produce something that other people will read. I'm not sure with memoir that's the primary idea. Now, and maybe some people do set out with that idea.
Well, I really. My initial impetus for writing a memoir is for myself to understand what the event meant. But at the same time, my memoirs have been read by just hundreds and hundreds of people, particularly women, but men too, who have had similar experiences. I mean, I think the reason why people read memoir is because they mirror their own lives. And a lot of people say don't have a voice, don't have the, you know, they're not writers. And, I mean, I studied writing, and I am a writer, so that's why I wrote my story. But I get emails and postings on my website, I mean, all the time from women who really thank me for telling their story, too. I mean, they say, you know, a lot of women who are struggling with sex addiction, they don't really even know that they have this addiction. They're just struggling with, you know, inappropriate sex and don't have boundaries and things like that. And so after reading my book, they say, oh, that's what I'm struggling with, too. And then they know how to go and find help. So there's a lot of mirroring of the world that we live in, sort of ordinary people, you know, not famous politicians or something. I mean, there's a real market and need for memoir in terms, you know, just because we are kind of women write about, you know, maybe putting a baby up for adoption. They meet people write about suffering from cancer. I mean, the memoirs that people write, a whole host of issues. And these are the things that everyday ordinary people are struggling with.
Well, I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, particularly for people who sometimes ask the question, well, why do we need these books? Why do we need books like this? And one of the reasons that we do need them is because people who are struggling with these sorts of things in their lives, I'm sure that it's really important, can be very helpful for them to know that they're not the only person ever to have dealt with that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I gave a reading when my first book is Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, and that's about, you know, struggling with my incestuous family. And I gave a reading at a library at the University of Georgia. And afterwards, you know, like everybody was sort of filing out of the auditorium, and this one woman was sort of hovering in the back. She was just clutching my book. And she came up to me, and she was just in tears. And she said, you know, you are the first person I've ever told that my father sexually molested me. She was too scared to even tell a therapist about it. But in some way, she trusted me just because I, you know, had written this book and sort of put myself out there. And she knew that I would understand this. And that's like amazing. I mean, like, you know, then I was in tears and we were both sort of standing there crying. But I mean, you know, it's just I was the first person she ever told. And there's just a huge need for memoirs. I mean, it really does, you know, reflect the human condition.
And I think, though, that also one can't understate how difficult doing this is. And I know for you, certainly, it was difficult. And I think, if I remember right, it was actually at the suggestion of the therapist that you were working with that you did it. And I'm sure that at the beginning, I'm sure that you thought, well, I can't possibly do this.
Oh, absolutely. My therapist, well, I actually started out as a fiction writer, and my fiction actually wasn't all that good, to be honest. but nevertheless, I was a writer. And my therapist, for several years, he kept saying, you know, stop writing fiction, write your own story. And I would say, oh, I don't have anything to say about myself, you know, forget it. And this went on for a couple of years. He kept saying, Sue, tell your own story, write your own story. And then finally, actually, my parents died. And as it so happens, they died within like 6 days of each other. And then my therapist said to me, well, maybe now you'll feel safe enough to write about yourself. And so sort of to humor him, I said, OK, you know, I'll write like one tiny little paragraph or something. And lo and behold, so I turned on my computer, and in 3 months, my first memoir, it just fell out of me. It was amazing. So, in fact, I had like 280 pages or something to write about myself. And that was just the first memoir I've been writing about myself ever since, which could sound sort of egotistical, but I really don't mean it to be that way. But it's just because it's about me, but it's not about me. You know, I mean, it really is thing. What I write about are really things that other people struggle with. But yeah, I mean, I really have my therapist for helping me to sort of get on this path of writing memoir.
Yeah. Now, as you say, the first book, that really just, it sounds like it just poured out, that it wasn't that difficult. But that Lovesick, the second book, that apparently was much more difficult to write and took a lot longer.
That's really true. I mean, you'd think I would have learned something, right, from the first book. But, yeah, the first book did just pour out of me. I could also say, though, that on some level, all of that sort of bad fiction that I've been writing for years, it's sort of been all of those novels that I'd been trying to write really were sort of about incest. So those were sort of like I was trying to write about myself but disguise it, and that's why they weren't working. So, yeah, it did fall out of me in about 3 months, but Lovesick took me about 5 years to write. It was much harder. And the reason why it was much harder is that it was hard for me to hear the sort of the sober voice trying to get better. I mean, Lovesick is written, they're kind of like two voices in Lovesick in a way. There's that tough sort of attic voice of like, you know, I'm really cool and men really love me and, you know, just a really kind of a false voice but that really sort of tough addict persona. But the book really is about recovering from sex addiction. And it was hard for me to sort of find that voice. So it took me about 5 years to write, which is normal, though. I mean, the first book that took 3 months, that's like a gift that you don't question, just like, thank you. But usually writing is much harder and takes much longer.
I have a caller here. I promise I'll not make them wait too much longer. I want to get right to them. But just to pick up on one thing, just again for a little bit, one of the things that I was wondering was, well, could you have written, because I remember Terror Father, I remember you, could you have written that as a novel? Or would that not have worked?
No, I mean, you know, every writer has his or her own way that they need to tell their story. Some people do write these as novels. Some people write them as poetry. For me, this is just a very personal thing. I did try writing Because I Remember Terror Father, I Remember You as novels, and it sounded artificial. It sounded inauthentic. It just didn't sound like me. And so for me personally, I absolutely could not have written it as a novel. It just didn't work. As soon as I started writing nonfiction or memoir, all of a sudden, it's just like my voice was there and I just heard it. And it just, so I'm just was kind of, as a writer, I'm just a nonfiction writer, even though, yes, I've written some poetry too, but I really am a memoir writer.
Our guest is Sue William Silverman, and her books are Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, also a collection of poetry, Hieroglyphics in Neon, and a book about writing memoir, which is titled Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir. She teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts. She's here visiting the campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival, and maybe I'll mention one more time that she will be doing a reading tomorrow afternoon, 4:30, at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner, along with Peter Orner. So if you'd like to hear some from her, and she will read a little bit for us, too, this morning. We do have a caller, so let's talk with them. This is someone who is listening in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to have a small conversation with the author. I'm very curious about what she's doing, and this is the reason. I grew up in an extremely violent family, and I feel a certain kind of similar experience here is because I found a way to deal with a lot of this through my artwork. And for the last 20 years, I've been pouring all my pain and my heart into my art, and I've done reasonably well with it, but this is the weird part for me. I feel reasonably like I've healed over time. Like I can face things, and I really don't have a relationship with my violent father or anything, but I feel okay. I mean, I've got a good life, I've got a good family, and I haven't carried this over into my generation, and I feel very, very proud of that aspect of my life. But this is the weird part for me, and this is why I wanted to talk to you. I feel you know, great and healed and healthy, and I have a wonderful relationship with my wife and my daughter, and this is the weird part, I feel like my art's died. For about the last year and a half, I've just kind of have gone nowhere. Like, I started looking at my stuff, and it's like, you know, this is formulaic, this is just method, this is like I have a cake pan, and I'm just making the same cake over and over, and it's like I have nothing more to say now that I feel like I've poured myself out into my work. And I'll be honest, I'm a little scared because, like, my identity has kind of been built up by my art. And now that I'm healthy, it's like I'm losing my heart on my art and kind of maybe losing my heart, too.
No, you know, that's a really, really good question. And I went through the same I had the same thing happen to me after I wrote these two memoirs. And then I sort of wrote the craft book, but that's kind of a different kind of energy. And then I thought, well, I have nothing else to say. But what I came to understand is that I had to start looking elsewhere and to find a different kind of voice to write in. And so it may be that maybe you need to, as an artist, you need to change your medium or change sort of like your world view or something. Like, I'm working on a collection of essays now, and they're not nearly as dark as the two memoirs, and the voice in them is much more ironic. But it took me a while to sort of start hearing a different kind of voice in which to write in. And so that's what I would suggest, is that, you know, don't put a lot of pressure on yourself, because that's always really, really tough. You know, then you start panicking and then you really can't do any work. Just kind of, you know, take a deep breath and just think about different things to explore through your art, different mediums, and a different sort of, in from an artist's perspective, a different voice in which to create in. And I really honestly think that you will find a different way to sort of express yourself, because we don't have to keep saying the same things over and over. Like, I don't want to keep, say, writing about my father over and over, or I don't want to keep writing about sex addiction. So now I have new material. So I think it's a matter of finding your new material and a new voice. And I really think you'll be okay. So take a deep breath, and I think you'll be all right.
Yeah, I do feel that way sometimes. But like I said, it's kind of weird for me. Like, a year and a half has gone by, and, you know, how deep of a breath can I take before it starts coming back?
Well, just start looking, but start thinking of it as a new voice and not trying to keep doing the same thing. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked in so many mediums and so many different methods. I mean, I've done printmaking, glassblowing, sculpture, painting. I pride myself on hopefully being remembered as an artist who just merely worked, as opposed to a painter. And I feel like that's given me a lot of freedom. And the things that I've had to say, I do try to change, like, you know, whether I'm doing portraiture or I'm doing landscape work or I'm doing abstract work or I'm doing commissions where I'm trying to find somebody else's voice in my work. It's just so strange to have this history in myself where I see myself as a creator, a maker, a person who builds, and now I've kind of built myself into a place where maybe I don't need that anymore. I'm glad to hear you say that you believe if I have this habit within me that I'll find a new voice.
I think you'll find it again.
It's so hard to reinvent, because I've reinvented myself so many times in so many ways to find something I'm reasonably happy with.
Yeah, but just don't give up.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm very interested in reading your book. I may come and see you tomorrow.
Yeah, please do.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We'll go on and talk with somebody else. Here's a caller in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was interested in your guest speaking about how she was able to even find a publisher who would publish something that wasn't, you know, sweet and light, because especially if you're talking about a memoir and it's something, it's a subject that isn't happy, how in the world did you find a publisher?
Well, actually, the first book that I wrote, I entered into a competition sponsored by the AWP, which is the Association for Writers and Writing Programs. Every year they sponsor a contest, and it's really for serious writers. And I can't remember what year now, 1997 maybe, it won in the category of creative nonfiction, and part of the prize was automatic publication with the University of Georgia Press. So that's how the first book got published, and the second book, Lovesick, I got an agent, and she sold it to Norton. No, I think for the most part, publishers really aren't particularly looking for sort of just lighthearted things. I mean, I think that a serious publisher really is looking for books that explore the human condition and the human psyche. It's kind of like a journey, you know, that you're sort of bringing the reader on like, you know, this is what it was like to grow up in my incestuous family, or this was like what it was like to struggle with sex addiction. So, no, I think that in some ways the darker it is, look, there's a market for everything, really. I mean, lighthearted, dark. But no, don't be discouraged. If you have to be true to the story. If the story is dark, you have to write it that way. If the story is ironic, you write it in that voice. So just really find the voice that will speak to the subject matter at hand. But there are tons of publishers out there, and they're all looking for good work. So, no, if you have a story to tell, absolutely, write it.
Oh, great. By the way, I think you are just really brave to put your story out there like that. It does take a lot of courage.
Thank you so much for calling.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. We're about midway through here talking with Sue Williams-Silverman. She's here visiting the campus for the Early Spring Literary Festival, something sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the English Department. A lot of interesting events and people like her here. If you want to find out more, the best thing to do is go to the webpage of the English Department, or you can just put in that phrase, Early Spring Literary Festival, in your browser. You'll find it. She is one of the people who's here, and she will be giving a reading tomorrow afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30 in the afternoon in the Author's Corner. She teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she is the author of these two memoirs, and we've mentioned them. The first, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. She also has a poetry collection, Hieroglyphics and Neon, and a book that is about writing memoir that's intended to be kind of a guide or something that will help people who want to write memoir. And that book is Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can email your thoughts to will-talk@illinois.edu. I think actually that within the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, it seems that there have been quite a few books of this kind published. As the kind of things that people sometimes refer to as confessional memoirs. And that's not necessarily intended to be a positive description, but that's kind of what gets applied to them. And many of these books, maybe most of these books, are written by women. And some people, I think, have raised this question, why have we seen so many of these books? Why is it that they sell so well?
I think women have been silenced for years, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I think it's been much more traditional that men get to tell their stories about war. You know, men go off to fight in World War II or Vietnam or Korea or, you know, Gulf War or whatever. And that's been sort of the traditional male memoir that's sort of expected, mm-hmm. that men come back and they write their memoir about war. What's been overlooked for years, however, is that the battles that women fight on the home front. I mean, I consider myself in many ways as having been a prisoner of war because I was held hostage by my parents. And, you know, I didn't have any way to escape. I didn't have a voice. I hardly even knew that what was happening to me was wrong. I mean, that was my life. That was all I knew. And so now in my generation of women, we have found our voices and we're telling our stories. And they're every bit as legitimate as the male sort of traditional memoir of, you know, sort of going off to fight wars. I say, you know, they fight wars on the foreign front. Women fight their wars on the home front. And they're both very, it's not like, you know, one's better or more important than the other. They're both really important stories. And the positive thing, too, though, is that men who also have grown up in abusive families, like one of your earlier callers, mm-hmm. Are also finding their voices. It's kind of like it used to be that what happened in the family should just stay there and there's a lot of shame and you don't tell family secrets. We're all raised with that, you know, like don't tell anybody, don't let the neighbors know that this is happening. And, you know, this is just something we keep in the family. well, then we just sort of, you know, maybe sort of the hippie flower child generation of, you know, sort of being, kind of trying to break stereotypes and speak out and sort of take on the establishment. I think in some ways that idea of speaking out maybe even evolved from that it is okay, you know, to sort of tell your own story. I mean, you know, my story belongs to me. I'm a writer. I get to tell it. And sure, there are people in my family who probably wish that I hadn't. Mm-hmm. But in a way, they don't get to decide that. I get to decide that because, you know, it is mine and it's my story to tell. And the reason why memoirs are so popular is because, you know, ordinary, everyday people really do relate to this. And so, yeah, there has been an explosion of memoir, and I think, yes, all to the best.
Well, I'd like to maybe pick up on something that the last caller said. The first book that is about your experiences having been sexually abused by your father.
Correct.
And it's really disturbing. I have to say I found the book really disturbing, although I would also say that there, at the end, when it seems like you, I as a reader, get the feeling like you're going to be okay, that helps. But you know, the things that you write about, there you're not shy about saying what happened in a very straight out way, and I'm sure that, you know, to talk about this with anyone, to talk about this with your therapist, to talk about this with your sister, to talk about this with your best friend, this would be difficult. But here it is, you're putting that down on the page for anybody who is going to come along and open that book. And I do think, as the caller said, I do think that's a courageous act. I'm what I wonder is where that courage comes from. How could you do that?
Thank you. I'm going to take that as a compliment.
It is certainly meant as one. Oh, yes.
And I think a lot of it is time. I mean, it's not like I could have written this book, you know, in my teens or even in my early 20s. I mean, I think it's, you know, it takes time to sort of find that sense of me being a strong adult woman. And the other piece of it, though, is that to me, having survived what my father did to me, I mean, that was the courageous part in a way. I lived, you know, and I didn't act it out in a negative way in terms of, you know, some incest survivors have murdered their parents, you know, like Susan Smith, that case in South Carolina where she drowned her two young sons. I mean, she'd been molested by her father. I mean, to turn that kind of really horrific experience into art, is, you know, of course, a positive way. It's a positive outlet. And also, it became harder for me to try to hold it in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that became the harder. For a long time, it was, you know, all I want to do is, like, not let anybody know anything bad ever happened to me. But living that lie took an enormous amount of energy, sort of like a pressure cooker. You're holding all of this in. And then finally, to start setting the words on paper, it really was kind of like releasing that pressure cooker. And I felt freer, I felt lighter. I can now just be here on this radio station with you and say, yes, my father sexually molested me, and know that it's okay for me to say this, that the earth's not going to stop spinning, or, you know, I mean, that my father's not going to, you know, I mean, he's dead, but, you know, that just bad stuff isn't going to happen. So to me, it's just all become a lot easier just to stop kind of holding secrets and stop telling lies and just, this is my truth. This is what happened to me, and just kind of putting it all out there. So ultimately, it really was easier to do that than to keep having everything just all bottled up inside.
Yeah. You mentioned your parents have passed away.
Yes.
And you write about that in the book.
Right.
That they both died very close to one another. Your mom, I think, had lung cancer.
Correct.
And your dad, he had, by the time that he died, he had dementia.
Right.
And I think what's amazing is that you still had a relation all that time. You still had a relationship with them, particularly with your father, and even to the point where he didn't even know who you were.
I know. I did. I mean, up until the end, I think the way I sort of see that now is that while my parents were dying, a lot of people said, well, how could you stand being with them? Mm-hmm. And I understand that, and I question that myself. How could I have done that? But I think it was that young little girl, even though I was an adult body at that point, there's that sort of inner child idea. I still think I was sort of holding out to the bitter end of getting some recognition from my parents of what they had done, like, or an apology, recognition, anything like that. And so I think it was sort of like that young inner part of me, sort of stubborn, you know, like holding out till a bitter mm-hmm. end, like, you know, oh, Dad, you know, even if it's on your deathbed, apologize. That'll make me feel better. And of course, you know, I didn't get that. And the intellectual adult me knew I wouldn't. But somehow I had to like see it through. And I don't regret it. And on the other side of it is that my parents were both very sickly at the end. And there I was, the strong one. And so I sort of felt more of a sense of my own power by watching them decline as I got stronger and stronger because I was in therapy at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that then by the time that they died, I was really ready. Okay, I can write my book now. I can tell my story.
Your mother knew what was going on?
I think that she, on some level, knew, but didn't talk about it. But how could you sort of not know? I mean, an incestuous family, it's not like it's just something that's, say, happening between, say, a daughter and a father. And in an incestuous family is very enmeshed. And on some level, you're all in on it together. So, yeah, on some level, she knew. But, you know, we didn't talk about it in the home. And so, of course, we weren't going to talk about it, you know, in public.
We have someone else to talk with. Let's do that.
Okay.
Someone in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. Uh-huh. A very interesting program. My question to your guest is if she has related to what we all go through with the extended patriarchal family. Family and patriarchy, I think, are synonymous. And the discombobulation that evolves out of that and the absolute power that males exercise in any venue, and especially the family, as opposed to the maternal family, which there's always the other side of things. If you have evolved any thoughts about how the patriarch then influences and, as a rule, overwhelms everyone beneath him.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that very much, I mean, pretty much all societies, well, Western societies are very patriarchal. And, you know, the men have had all the power. They have the money. You know, like in my generation, I mean, my parents grew up in the Depression, but my father did go on to have a really good career. But my mother had no money at all. And I think that that doesn't excuse her for why she didn't say, take my sister and me and leave and just, you know, try and find a, you know, a way to take care of herself. But so it doesn't excuse her, but I think that is a reason why is that, you know, women were brought up to think that the male sort of calls all of the shots and women didn't have the money. And I think a lot of that is changing now and all for the good. But yes, I agree with you. Thank you. Good question.
Could I say one more thing, David?
Sure.
Yes. If that being the case, Westerners perceive themselves as hitting the jackpot with the patriarchal family, but the Eastern societies, it is even more pronounced. You know, veiled women and the abuse, and recently I saw on the 10 greatest shots for National Geographic magazine, a young girl that had her nose cut off. And I don't think they did that to each other. I think that was the influence of the patriarchy, you know, which the monogamy that the male demands, and then his own advance into polygamy. Therein, I think, is the key.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, that's really. It's just horrifying what's going on in some countries and the way, you know, women are treated. I mean, they're really treated as a property. and they don't have a sense of themselves. They aren't able to be sort of fully realized human beings or women. And I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you.
And I appreciate the comments of the caller, and other people certainly can participate. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, as we talk with Sue Silverman. You in your first book, sort of late in the story and late in your father's life, you relate this conversation that you had with him. I think it was over the telephone, where he said to you that he had been sexually abused by his mother and aunts. And I guess it makes me think that here, while the kind of dynamic that the caller points to is you can't exactly deny that, that this is more than just a male person exercising power over a female person. It's a bigger person exercising power over a smaller person.
Exactly. That's really part of it, too. And, of course, like, where does this all start? I mean, nobody is born a child molester. And so, yes, my grandmother, my father's mother, did molest him. I think what my father said was true. But my guess is that she was also molested by somebody. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a generational thing. I mean, that's what's so scary about it, until you sort of break that and say, so then in my generation, you know, I knew that this, you know, I sought therapy. I knew that I needed to get help. And so then you kind of break that pattern. But I think it's very generational. And, you know, sort of like alcoholism can run in families, things like that. And so, yeah, it's not, you know, women also molest their sons. That's absolutely true. And it's sort of who has the power and whether you use that power for good or for ill.
Just to go on and talk, to have you give you a chance to talk a little bit about Lovesick, which is the first, as we've explained, the first book is this memoir that's about talking about your experiences having been sexually molested by your dad for a large part of your life. And then Lovesick is about your experiences dealing with sex addiction. And I'm sure that a lot of people would say, having had that experience of being sexually molested by a parent, how it is that anybody would have any interest in sex at all, how it is that that can then turn into an uncontrollable pursuit of that kind of intimacy.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think from the women who I met in rehab, it sort of was all or nothing. Some women never had sex because it was so terrifying to them. And then others of us would act out sexually. Mm-hmm. And there, I think there are a few reasons why. One is that growing up, that's all I knew. When my father would molest me and he would say he loved me, so I misunderstood then the difference between love and sex. So then when I was an adult and acted out with these, you know, sort of dangerous men, I was looking for love. I mean, it really didn't have so much about have to do with sex that much. But I just kept sort of thinking, oh, you know, one of these men surely will love me. And that will sort of then in that very strange, magical thinking kind of way meant that my father had actually loved me. So it was really sort of repeating the pattern of childhood, since that's how my father showed his love. That's how, as an adult, I sought love, was through sex. The other piece of it is that growing up in my incestuous family, I was leading a double life. On the surface, we looked absolutely perfect. You know, my father had this good career. We had, you know, nice cars, nice house, the whole thing. And then as a sex addict, I was married. I looked perfectly respectable. And so, again, I repeated that pattern of childhood of living a double life, which, you know, on the surface, everything seemed perfect. But that was just a facade that hid this sort of dark secret of mine. And then the addiction, whether it's sort of your drug of choice, whether you become an alcoholic, have a sex addiction, have an eating disorder, that's used to numb out, to numb your feelings. Like what happened with my father was so awful and so scary that it's sort of like, what is my drug of choice so that I can numb out and not have to really face what he did? So I would be obsessive about these men, and by being obsessive about these men and whether they love me or what was going to happen with them, I could sort of ignore the fact that, you know, basically my whole childhood even existed. So it's really using sex as a drug in many ways. And by the way, I just want to mention that I'd like to give you my website address, because all my contact information is there. and I would love to hear from you. My website address is www.suewilliamsilverman.com. If you just Google me, you know, Sue Silverman or Sue William Silverman, you'll be able to find my website address, and there are ways to contact me on there. And so if you're struggling in the same way, you know, please feel free to contact me. Or if you're in the area, come and meet me tomorrow at my reading.
Sure. Would you like to read a little bit from Lovesick?
I would love to, actually. Thank you. What I'm going to do, okay, so Lovesick is basically about the 28 days that I spent in rehab recovering from the sex addiction. And I'm just going to read a couple of minutes of the beginning of the book, just before I enter the rehab unit. So this is from Lovesick. Every Thursday at noon, I have sex with Rick in room 213 of the Rainbow Motel. Today, even though I promised my therapist I wouldn't come here again, I pull into the lot and park beside Rick's black Ford Bronco. I cut the engine and air conditioner and listen to stillness, to nothing, to heat. Sun rays splinter the windshield. Heat from the pavement rises, stifling around the car, around me. A neon rainbow, mute and colorless by day, arcs over a sign switched to vacancy. Only the little girl from India, daughter of the motel owner, invigorates the stasis. Holding a string tied to a green balloon, she races down the diving board and leaps into the swimming pool. With the windows closed, I can't hear the splash. If she laughs, I can't hear this either. The girl's energy exhausts me, as much as the stagnation of neon air time. I close my eyes. Still, I sense no darkness, no cool shadows, no relief from the scorching Georgia heat. Rather, a harsh light, white as a sheet, penetrates my lids as if I am caught in an unforgiving glare. I worry the girl by the pool will see me. She's too young to know what I do here in the Rainbow Motel. I should leave. I should leave here now. I should grasp the balloon and let it waft me across the sky, far from my implacable need for men. These men see me as an object, a body. They are men incapable of love, even though I endlessly, addictively, try to convince myself that sex at noon for an hour with a married man has to be the real thing, must be love. So I can't leave here. I need Rick one last time, one last high, one last fix. I should drive to the rehab unit and find my therapist right now.
That's Sue William Silverman reading from her memoir, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. She is visiting Champaign-Urbana. She's here to take part in the Early Spring Literary Festival. It's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program. Let me also mention one more time, she will be giving a reading, and this will be tomorrow afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30 in the afternoon, at the Author's Corner. So if you'd like to meet her or hear more from her, you can stop by. You can also find out more about the festival by going to the English Department website. And I guess I just really want to say, you know, for people who've been listening now to us up to this point, that I think that the quality of your writing is really, really fine.
Oh, thank you.
I think that that's also, I don't know, maybe if you're a writer, if one is a writer, you can pull away from the subject matter to look at it technically. And to say, you know, everything that we have said, what it's about, what it means to you, what it means to readers. And I think, though, one also has to say it's really good writing.
Thank you.
I don't think that's always the case in the kind of writing that we're talking about.
Well, thank you. That does mean a lot to me. I mean, I did write for years and years. You know, I sort of paid my dues, and I wrote a long time before I published anything. And I think that's what it takes. I mean, you do have to sort of find that voice and your metaphor in a way to convey your experience in that kind of literary way. Yeah.
We have about 5 minutes. We have a couple callers. We'll get one at least, if not both. First in line is Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I remember reading a book called The Obsidian Mirror, which is about an adult healing from incest, and it was an eye-opener for me. I have not read your book, but I plan to, and I plan to suggest it to my book group. Well, part of what was eye-opening to me was the lack of control that this person felt, and as you said, her confusion as a child because of her experience of love of associating sex with meaning that someone loved you. And she felt totally out of lacking in control over her sexuality. It was something for somebody else to control. And so she became promiscuous. And to me, it gave an insight as to why somebody might, a reason why somebody might behave in this way, and a reason why somebody might also fail to use birth control if they do not feel as though they have any control over what's going on. Of course, everybody, I'm sure there are lots of different reactions to things. I also heard recently when I was out of state and listening to an NPR station, it was a yoga instructor who is a possessive compulsive, and she was talking about how she found peace with yoga meditation, and that she had experienced part of her problem was that she had been sexually abused as a child, and for her, in the way that she was abused, she had both the feelings of terror and of pleasure, and she couldn't figure out as a child how to sort this all out, so she felt both terrorized and guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really common to have, you know, we're such complex, you know, creatures, human beings, and I think that there is that kind of range of feeling. I mean, when I was acting out in the sex addiction, I felt both out of control and totally in control, both at the same time. I mean, I felt control, you know, knowing, I felt really powerful and in control knowing a man wanted me, but at the same time, like after the sex was over and he didn't really need me, then I would just sort of spiral out of control. So it was kind of like this balance between the two. So, yeah, I totally understand that.
The other thing that I find interesting is that some people will say, well, this is just an excuse, and people should just get control of themselves. And why are you talking not just about this, but about anything where we're trying to understand human behavior? To me, understanding, and you're sharing your story, is a way to find solutions to problems. It isn't, I'm sure you're not writing this as an excuse. You're trying to understand
absolutely
the problem. And I find it really counterproductive to not stand up. No, I'm not talking about you. I'm
sure
part responding to something I saw on somebody's Facebook page recently. I'm thinking, you know, what is this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's not, I don't write as an excuse, and I don't think that, you know, these things are really serious and they're really hard, and it's a real struggle. And I, you know, when I write in Lovesick, I'm as hard on myself as I am on anybody else. I mean, it really is to take the reader and myself through this journey. I mean, it's an exploration, and thank you so much for saying that. That really means a lot to me, because it isn't about excuses. It's not about blaming anybody. It's not about revenge. It's none of those things. I write to really understand what happened to me. So thank you. That's great to hear.
And I need to jump in here. We're just about at the end of the time, but I guess I feel that we talked about in this in the beginning, I think, when we talked a little bit about the value of this kind of writing, but I think that for you, the value, the reason that you started out doing it in the first place, and the value for you personally, is that as a part of your, I don't know if healing is the right. She's nodding, so I guess that's an okay word to use. As the part of your healing, writing this for you was therapeutic.
Yes, I mean, writing about the past, or writing, you know, the past can be yesterday, but I mean, writing is a way to kind of organize your life. It's a way to make sense of it. And it's a way to understand it. It's a way to understand the metaphor of the experience. And so that is part of the healing process, for sure. I mean, and now that the books are out there and I can, you know, meet other people, I mean, it's all sort of part of the process and part of the journey. So absolutely.
And just one other thing, and again, the comments of the caller made me think about it, and that is this and you seem to write about it a lot in the first book. This the fact that sex really becomes associated with pain, and it seems, you know, in as much as then later on, sex might be something that you would seek out because it's a way of numbing other feelings, or a way of taking yourself out of yourself for a while, or, you know, however you would describe it. But there always seemed to be this real association between sex and the sex act and pain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you're an emotional pain and physical pain, I mean, when your father who, you know, tells you he loves you, and of course you assume your father loves you, but yet what he's doing is causing pain. I mean, it's so confusing to a little kid. I mean, you have no way to sort of process this or understand that. And so then you, as an adult, as I grow up, I mean, I didn't know the difference between pleasure and pain, sex and love. I mean, I was so confused until, you know, both through therapy and through the writing, I began to make sense of my life. But I do want to emphasize that, you know, for me, the writing memoir, it's not about revenge. It's not about excuses. It is to understand. And another message I really want to convey is that for anybody out there who's still struggling, I really want you to know that there's help out there. There's hope out there. You really don't have to be alone. I mean, there you can find, you know, people who can help you, therapists. You know, feel free to contact me and I can help, you know, you find somebody. But I know it can be a dark and lonely, scary place, and there is a way out, and I want you to know that.
Our guest, Sue Williams-Silverman, is here visiting the campus. She's taking part in the Early Spring Literary Festival, and you can find out more about that by going to the English Department website. They're the sponsor. She will be giving a reading tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore, so anyone should feel welcome to stop by there. Her books, and you can find them in the bookstore, are Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction. She has a collection of poetry. The title is Hieroglyphics in Neon, and then has the book that's about memoir writing, that is Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir. She teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts. And again, if you'd like to find out more about her, or maybe you'd like to get in touch with her, easy thing to do is go to her website, which is her name, Sue William Silverman, all squished together, no spaces, SueWilliamSilverman.com, and you can do that. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. This has just been an amazing interview. I really appreciate your really good questions.